And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Every day we wake up and have to decide what to do. For most everyone, we barely have enough time to really consider the options. But think for a moment how life would be different if one day you woke up and just began walking and just walked away from all that mattered that day. Today, we're looking at the changes in course we make or are made for us, or which happen without us even knowing. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the interesting things about internet radio is that it's radio on demand. Each of you gets to tune in precisely when you want. You choose when to listen. And although there's a new show each Thursday, for some reason, a lot of you tune in on Monday. I find that interesting. Why Monday? And because you have listeners from all over the world, although I can see what time each person logs on, I see a bar graph for every hour of the day. I can't know if the spike at 5 p.m. is because people are at home in New York and tuning in, or is it that listeners perhaps in Russia find it a good time to tune in at a very different time in their world. I'm one who likes choices. Sometimes I feel closed in when the choice is narrow. Others sense such limited choices as security or stability. I can't say why that difference exists. Today we're focusing on choices. Following the news, which is coming up shortly, we head down to Plano, Texas, and talk with the administrator of the Silverado Living Care Centers, special care facilities that cater to people who are losing their capacity to make choices, people suffering specifically from Alzheimer's. And we talk with Travis Fogel about the significance animals play in maintaining a quality and a connection for people whose connectedness unceremoniously just melts away. Then in segment two, Americans went out and expressed their choices at the polls, and now we're faced with a whole new box of choices as the balance of power shifts at the national and state levels. Will this affect the choices we have to make to deal with the choices we've made in the past, which are forcing us to make some hard choices about things which are forcing us to change? And in our third segment, maps provide almost unlimited choices as to how we chart our progress. Maps provide real facts about how to get from Dallas to Des Moines and gives us options. Do we take the freeways or the byways? We talk with an expert from MapLinks about maps of all sorts, choices and the courses they chart. It's all coming up. But first, the news. Severe storms ripped through the southern states, bringing fierce winds, driving rains, and spawning a series of tornadoes that left communities picking up the pieces to try to put their lives back in order. One tornado danced its way along a 2-mile-wide path, destroying homes and toppling trees on a 4-mile-long clean sweep of destruction. Japan continues its unfashionable and unconscionable ways as once again its whaling fleet heads out to do research on whales, or perhaps that should be, its research vessels head out to conduct deadly whaling practices destined to kill 850 minke whales and 10 fin whales in the name of science. Japanese officials claim the program and the use of lethal harpoons are needed to gauge whale populations and to study their breeding and feeding habits. Meat from the catch is sold commercially, and canned or frozen whale is sold in large supermarkets, although the taste for whale is being supplanted generally by a craving for Whoppers. This signals the launching of 4 protest ships as once again Greenpeace and Captain Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd head out to push their way between the researchers and the whales. And meanwhile, along the coast of Japan, the annual drive hunt has begun. During the hunt, fishing boats use loud noises to herd bottlenose dolphins into shallow bays, where they are corralled into nets and killed. Some of the best dolphins are chosen to be sold to aquariums, fetching a dandy 50 grand or so for a good dolphin, which may become a superstar attraction and entertain millions of visitors during its lifetime. However, for the 20,000 or so dolphins and porpoises estimated to be killed during the hunt each year, they end up in cans to provide a replacement for the limited whale catch mandated by the International Whaling Commission, or as fertilizer. Meanwhile, in marine research facilities around the world, the communion between dolphin and human continues to awaken even scientists to the conclusion that these animals are sentient, caring, compassionate, and intelligent creatures which recognize family and friends, cry out in pain, and save lives of stranded sailors, as they have for millions and millions of years. The oceans continue to startle us with breaking news of their demise each week, and now a study reports that deep sea trawling is destroying underwater mountains that are generally teeming with life and killing myriads of fish, some of which are hundreds of years old. With global fisheries management forcing creative fishing techniques in unregulated areas of the ocean to justify fishing at all, vast stretches of the ocean are being shredded in the attempt to locate fish that can be sold in markets around the world. It is estimated that the total catch from bottom trawling was valued at $280 million, or about the cost of one day of war in a far-off land known as Iraq. And finally, a 38,000-year-old Neanderthal bone fragment has served as the source to unlock a sizable portion of the genetic mystery of the Neanderthal genome. The bone, discovered in a cave, has provided scientists with enough genetic material to unwind the lineage which humans share with a common ancestor. About 500,000 years ago, genetics split the paths, with Neanderthals heading off on one path, while Homo sapiens headed off on another. It is estimated that the last Neanderthal died a mere 28,000 years ago. Scientists have long acknowledged that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals shared the Earth for quite some time. But as so often happens, lower beings fall to the greater intelligence of the human species, which through their great intelligence may finally win the great intelligence wars by eliminating grand portions of lower life on Earth. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Next week's show falls on Thanksgiving Day, and because I happen to demand that I cook the Thanksgiving dinner, I'm taking the day off. So I've come up with a traditional Thanksgiving show, which is directed at kids and the kickoff to the holidays. Now, some of you have heard the Santa Fe Christmas Story, and if you haven't, drag the kids of all ages around your computer monitor, turn up the volume, and take a little journey. That's next week. And the following week, Dr. David Suzuki, one of the world's most admired teachers about the grand wonders of life, nature, and the earth, will be joining us here on the Wild Side News. That's 2 weeks from now. So now I choose to talk about something that almost everyone has faced or will face sometime in their lives, often whether we choose to or not. Almost everybody has a family, and they have friends, and there's probably nothing more important in reality than our family and our friends. And we have a close friend who recently, actually over a period of time, we've witnessed has changed. And whereas we didn't quite understand it all, we just assumed that she was just getting older. Recently, she fell, and suddenly there was attention brought to the fact that she was needed a little more care than people thought. And when all things were said and done, it turns out that she's actually heading into a place that is very painful for everybody, for her and for those around her, the people who care for her. She's suffering from some form of perhaps dementia or Alzheimer's, that is to be determined. But in the process of trying to help figure out where to go next, because she was in an apartment, we stopped over locally here in Encinitas to the Silverado Senior Living Center, which really focuses on people who are heading into the realms of Alzheimer's and provides exceptional care and very specific care, which is different than you'd find in other homes. So joining us to talk about that, and there's a very specific reason that we're going to be talking now with Travis Fogel, who's the administrator at the Silverado Senior Living Center in Plano, Texas. Travis, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, here's what happened, Travis. My friend walked into, who was helping our other friend, walked into the home, and she talked about that this morning and said, you know, the thing that struck me was the fact that there were animals everywhere. There were dogs, there were cats, there were birds, and I said, I get it. That is so, so interesting. And quite honestly, the Silverado communities really focus on including animals as part of their care for people with Alzheimer's or dementia. Let's start to explore, first of all, what's kind of the history of this? How long have homes been really focusing on bringing animals in?
Well, Silverado Senior Living is celebrating our 10th year of being in business. And ever since our inception, Mr. Steve Winter, our Chief of Culture, Vice President, and Co-Founder, actually was instrumental in starting the eating concept, but found out that was not a real conducive plan and sometimes not practical for many organizations. So he was instrumental in beginning our pet philosophy and pet care policies within Silverado Senior Living. And it's sort of all part of our life concept. Everything within our communities focuses around life, which stands for love, innovation, family, and engagement. And so it's pretty much been around since the inception of our company, and one of our core values is pets within our communities.
Well, that's very interesting, because a lot of people would say, my gosh, pets, that seems to add a lot of care requirements. And I'm sure there's many people who might think that people who are suffering from Alzheimer's may not even know how to effectively deal with animals. But I have to believe there's another story, and I'd like to explore that a little bit. Talk to me about why pets play such a role in your care.
Yeah, I'd love to. Pets are just vital to life in general, we feel, in our communities. They add a lot to our communities. In a sense, they give residents purpose. If they have a chore to go take a dog for a walk, in many of our communities, we even have miniature horses. We have llamas. We have even a kangaroo in one of our communities. We have many cats, fish, birds, and all those even revolve around maybe a pet club where we get out all of our animals. Our animals are actually held daily and stroked and touched. And many times that same animal gives them a sense of comfort, knowing that they belong. It also comforts our family members. Our families come to the community maybe not knowing how to communicate with their loved one anymore. Maybe the loved one cannot communicate, cannot formulate sentences, know how to communicate. But when they go with a walk with a dog in their hand and go outside in our large courtyards, all of a sudden things are better, and there's no need for communication because you're enjoying a wonderful day with a pet or an animal. And so it just brings a lot of life back to our family members where at once maybe they felt uncomfortable, could not communicate. It gives them another sense of communication.
Well, I've done a little bit of research, and I'm certainly no expert on this, although I do have instincts about it. I've heard stories that in some cases there have been people who've been very distant, perhaps even unreachable, and almost incommunicable. And then a pet comes around and something happens. Have you had a chance to witness that? That's almost like the awakening happens. Have you had a chance to witness that and tell us about that?
Oh, I'd love to tell you about that, Sydney. We see that, I would say, not necessarily a daily basis, but definitely a very frequent basis. We see where pets bring back to life our residents. For example, a lady named Sarah came to our community, and she was pretty much at end of life and ready to pass away, and wasn't wanting to get out of her bed, was not wanting to be a part of the community, and just laid in bed, and the family had just concluded that she was going to pass away. Well, Tigger, one of our little cats, decided that she was going to take up home with Sarah, and so every day that cat would sit right on Sarah's chest, every day, and eventually Sarah began to stroke that cat, pet that cat, and eventually began to come out of the community with the cat, and now even today Sarah is up walking, talking, interacting with all of our community. So things that at once gave no purpose at all to our residents, pets bring a huge purpose to them and bring value and give them a comfort level. And that's just one story of many that we have. Even our pets, our dogs, play a huge role where maybe they're not interactive, they're not smiling, have a flat affect, and all of a sudden a pet comes up and licks their hand, and begin a big smile comes over their face, and they begin to stroke the animal. And so pets play a huge role in giving life to our residents.
I'm sure you've given a lot of thought, and you've had a chance to watch this happen. But what I'd be curious to explore a little bit, and that is, what is it that you think is that connection? What is the power of that connection between the animal? How does that work with people who they don't know their, in some cases, they may not even recognize their daughters or their children. They don't recognize friends any longer. They almost don't recognize anything, but something about that connection. What, from your perspective, happens? How does that happen?
Well, I think throughout our lives, most memorable experiences, you know, things that we retain in our long-term memory are things that have an emotional attachment to them. And so as we're finding that many times people have emotional attachment to pets and animals in their past, and so it's been a good experience for them, and it's always been a part maybe of general life. Maybe they didn't have pets in their home, back in the 20s or the early teens, but they definitely had pets a part of their environment. And so it brings back lots of good, pleasant memories that are stored in their long-term memory, which is typically the last thing to go with the Alzheimer's or memory care patient.
There's another side to the story. And there's a lot of tales about how animals seem to perceive illness, seem to perceive various kinds of danger. And I'm just curious if you have a sense that these animals somehow, for example, I interviewed a paraplegic with canine companions, and he told the most amazing story. He was a gentleman who couldn't move at all, and he would have seizures at night. He'd been in a terrible car accident, and he was companioned with a dog, a puppy, quite honestly, probably 9 months to 11 months old, who'd gone through the training. And the first night he was lying in bed, and he started to have a seizure, and the dog jumped up onto the bed and lay on him to keep him, it stilled him and it kept him in the bed. It was an instinct to react. It's a most amazing story. Yeah. But that's one of many, many stories. I'm just curious to what extent you think these animals perceive that these people require a different kind of care from them.
Yeah, I think they definitely have that special sense to know when they're needed and loved. Even if a resident maybe is near death in one of our communities, you'll see the actual pets begin to wander toward that room. Like there's a special sense that draws them to know that they're needed there. And I've seen a pet, actually a dog, when a resident was outside walking, one of our trails had fallen. And a dog, I've seen them just bark and bark and bark until actually it gets a caregiver's attention to come out there to know that something's not right, something's not normal within that person's daily routine. And that's it's an amazing sense that animal has, a sense of connection with our resident. And it really brings a lot of life to our communities, even tears. You know, we've seen a lot of our family members who just get very emotional over the fact that, you know, my mom would have never wanted a cat in her home, but yet here she sets and strokes this cat and loves on it and kisses on it like it's her own child. And so it really brings a lot of emotion back to families.
One of the amazing things about animals is the fact that they, well, with some exceptions, dogs in particular give literally unconditional love. It's absolutely
true.
Amazing. No matter who you are, if that dog and you are bonded, it's always happy to see you. It's always thrilled to be with you. And these animals that you have in your facility now, are some of these actually owned by residents, or are they more or less a community resource?
Well, we actually have certain pet to resident ratios that we follow. Even by having community dogs, that doesn't necessarily include a resident's dog. We encourage our residents to bring their pet from home. If it's a dog, if it's a cat, if it's a bird, whatever animal they're used to having at home, we encourage them to bring that as a part of their daily life. But we also have our community animals, which we follow our very strict policy that we want to have, for example, a 1 to 20 in regards to a dog ratio for one dog for every 20 residents. So some of our communities may have 5 to 7 dogs in our communities because we have communities as small as, you know, 35, but as large as, you know, 130. So many of our communities have maybe 5 or 6 community dogs, and then maybe they have 3 or 4 other dogs in the community that the residents own. And then each of those pets are actually assigned responsibilities throughout the day in regards to which residents are going to be taking care of them, where the leashes are stored, where the dog food is kept, and it's always a resident engagement activity, and the residents are involved with every detail of that animal's life.
I know that people who are elderly very often just literally lose their connection with time and with purpose and other things. One of the stories that comes from the Silverado community is the fact that this really does help the elders with this special condition really start to develop a sense of rhythm, a sense of time, a sense of responsibility, not on a grand scale, but in some cases, any sort of advancement is a dramatic advancement. Talk about that.
Well, we've been seeing the case where, we get into routine many times. We try to keep with a schedule and routine for our residents. And many times if we're maybe busy and forget to take a dog out at exactly the 2 o'clock walking time, we've even had a resident come up, and say, well, it's time to walk the dog. And not knowing even any concept of time, but knows that, hey, I haven't walked the dog in a while, and I'm ready to walk that dog. So many times their routine now has been formulated, and it's got something memorable attached to it, which is very pleasant to them. And so therefore they start to develop a sense of worth and value, and that's what we instill in every one of our residents, is that they are valuable. Just because they have this memory disease and memory impairment, they're still very valuable to our society and still have great impact and worth in our communities.
Now, of course, your staff as well has to be specially trained in some respects to to accommodate both to the pets and to your community residents there. What sort of special awareness do they have to be provided with to help in this process?
Well, we have several in-services that we require for all of our associates in regards to pet care and our pet policies. And it's very important, when they come on board to even interview in the interview process, that we introduce them not only to our residents and other associates, but we interview our potential associate to our pets. And we make sure that they're going to be a good fit, because not everybody enjoys working around pets and can work with pets. And the same thing goes, with residents who are inquiring. We want to make sure that it's a good fit, because we feel like it's a core value of ours that we just aren't willing to separate with, because pets add so much value to our life and to our associates and to our residents and their families. So in part of that training that we provide to our associates in regards to pet care, we talk about how that, yes, you may be assigned the task of maybe cleaning out a litter box or feeding the horses or taking the dogs on walk, but everything that you're assigned to do and your responsibility is always about taking a resident with you and making that an engagement activity and not just your sole responsibility. And that goes from every aspect of our daily lives here at Silverado. If it's from making an errand to Walmart or to Home Depot or wherever we may go, we take residents with us. The same thing happens on any kind of responsibility we have with our pets, and we make sure that resident engagement is at the core of all we do.
Just because you're on the phone, and because I can appreciate that you're a very sensitive and dedicated soul, I've lived with Alzheimer's in my history, relatives who've gone through this. I have some elderly friends who are a mother, et cetera, And we're going to move a little bit out of the realm of animal care specifically, but what I would like to have you share is advice to people who are facing this, because it's possibly one of the most difficult things a person can face. For example, I personally am in a situation where I'm trying to figure out to what degree do I try to help someone who I'm caring for try to maintain versus realizing the limits of their maintenance. And that's a really fine line, because everyone hates to see that consciousness, that awareness, and that appreciation slipping away. Give us some advice on how we can personally deal with this, and also just practically what steps we can do to make this easier.
Yeah, I'd love to help you out a little bit, Sydney. I tell you what, memory disease is just one of the saddest diseases probably that is known, Alzheimer's itself and memory loss. Just breaks your heart, because it not only, it's something that is hard for people to grasp. It's not like something that they can see physically wrong with them. Some days they remember who they're talking to, and it's their daughter. Other days they don't remember. Maybe some days they remember to take the medication. Other days they can't. So it's very hard for us to grasp and put our finger on what's causing it. Mental illness in general is hard for people to understand. People who are diagnosed with bipolar and other diseases, we think, well, why can't they just get over it or do those kind of things? It's the same thing with memory loss. It's very difficult, and it causes lots of guilt and other emotional turmoils among families who are dealing with this memory loss, because they don't know how to handle it and know how to respond, because some days mom's doing great, other days mom's doing bad. So they get to a point where eventually they're going to be faced with a crisis, and then they're going to have to make a decision. And many times that's what they put off until a crisis occurs, or maybe until they need more care. Maybe they become incontinent and realize they can't handle those incontinency issues anymore, and so they're going to need help with those incontinency problems. Or maybe it's to a point where maybe they need medications, and the medications that the loved one is taking, they're not able to dispense, or maybe they need injections. And so there's usually a crisis, or mom falls, you know, and needs some help. At that point, they have to make a decision and have to decide if they're going to get home care or place someone in a community. And many times, what they find out is once they let go of that guilt and come to the realization that there is something wrong with my loved one and she isn't and who she used to be, and these are the best years of her life, she's not going to get better because there is no cure currently for Alzheimer's and memory loss. You're seeing the best years of her life today. There's drugs that have been shown to slow down the disease process, but nothing that actually prevents it or reverses it at this time. So once they come to the realization that they can accept some help and let someone start being the caregiver rather than that person being the caregiver, the family member can all of a sudden become the advocate for the loved one and can decide, hey, you know, mom is going to get good care. Now that mom's in this facility, look how much engagement she's getting now, how much more involvement she has. She has so much more stimulation and engagement with other residents and animals and pets and friends and entertainment. All of a sudden, this secluded life she lived at home, fearful that someone might actually know that she has memory loss, has now become something she's not afraid of and she's not fearful of. So it just opens up a whole new aspect for families once they actually get to the point where they can accept someone to help them. It's very difficult for them to get to that point, though, and many times that's just what we do. We just try to be their memory care resource, because not everybody maybe belongs at Silverado, but we want them to know that we're here to help them and be able to help them find a place that meets their needs, and that's our goal. We just want to meet the needs of that loved one and get them to where they need to be. Maybe they need home care, you know, maybe they need actually placed in a community somewhere, or maybe they even need end-of-life care, and we want to be that resource for them.
Finding the right home is a challenge as well. It's very important to be sure that you do the background and check things out. And I will have to say the fact that you have exhibited this awareness of the importance of animals in the care of people suffering from Alzheimer's indicates a true dedication to serving their needs. Tell us about the Silverado communities.
Our Silverado communities are just full of life. We try to accommodate our residents' needs. Many times in Alzheimer's dementia care, people are so worried about controlling people's behavior and their actions. Well, it's our desire that we feel like we can't control anyone. We feel like we should accommodate them. The answer is always yes in all of our communities. Whatever they need, the answer is yes. You won't hear the word no, stop, can't, you can't, don't. Those are things we don't say in our communities because we want them to be full of life and full of people who are very valued in society. They've been work productive lives, all of a sudden because they have this disease doesn't mean that they're not valued anymore. So everything we do in our communities brings life to our residents. They have country kitchens in our communities that residents can go anytime, day or night, and get food from the fridges, either be a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a ice glass of milk, maybe an ice cream from the freezer. They are available to them 24 hours a day. We also have 24-hour life saving nursing care in our communities, which is rare. You don't find that most of the time in assisted livings and other places, along with a very low staffing ratio of 1-7, one caregiver to seven residents, and those are direct care staff. And we also have master-level social workers in our community, as well as geriatric-trained specialists. So, but even though a lot of other communities have staff, we feel like our number one thing that we do really well is that we just give life to residents. We love on them, we truly care about them, and we are committed to putting our residents first. And that comes from the top down, from our corporate office there in San Juan Capistrano, all the way to our frontline staff, our caregivers and housekeepers and laundry workers. They truly want to make a difference in people's lives and feel that they have gone away at the end of the day knowing that they've impacted a life and changed somebody's life for the better.
Silverado communities aren't located in every state. Tell us where they are. You're also on an expansion curve, and I'd like you to as well share how people can find out more about the Silverado.
Sure. Currently, we have communities in California, Utah, and Texas. We've been growing by about 3 to 4 communities per year. And if you'd like to find out more about Silverado Senior Living, you can go to the webpage at silveradosenior.com. And there it has also information about our corporate office, all of our communities, and even takes some online tours of our community.
Well, Travis Fogel, administrator with the Silverado Senior Living Center in Plano, Texas, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much, Sydney.
For some, life is becoming one with the mystery. For others, life is a mystery. And for some, it's time to get to work and try to head off what many are saying could be a very uncertain and complicated future. Bruce Hamilton of the Sierra Club talks about the choices we need to make when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
For many of us who factor nature and animals, forests and clean rivers into our concept of things that truly matter, last week's election turned our way. Americans made choices and chose to change direction. And we're all chirping about just how great it is. So, what now? We talk with someone who keeps working for change and speaks to the importance of choices. He's the National Conservation Director for the Sierra Club. It's coming up. Stay tuned. We've had a whole week to think about the election. Many of us are celebrating because it feels as if things kind of went in the direction of electing candidates who, well, what shall I say? They're Democrats. I mean, we can just start with that. There's many aspects to this, and I would like to really get some true expertise, and that's why we're talking with Bruce Hamilton, who is joining us now from San Francisco. He's the National Conservation Director for the Sierra Club. Bruce, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's quite a story. I'm going to let you tell us what you've been thinking about and the Sierra Club since the election last week.
Well, this was really a seismic shift in the political landscape. It is very infrequently that you have a change of control of the House of Representatives. True, it happened in 1994 when Newt Gingrich came in with a contract with America, but you would have to reach back to the early 1950s to find another time when that happened. The shift in control of the Senate happens more frequently, but the House, it is a very rare occurrence. And to actually have both chambers shift over is even more monumental. But I would, at the same time, want to be talking about the shifts that have happened in state legislatures and locally, too, because this wasn't just a congressional seismic shift, but in fact the entire country was moving more in the direction of moderation and away from the radical right anti-environmental agenda that has been promoted for the last 8 years. And so this is really a, I think, wonderful opportunity for environmentalists and for other people that care about the fate of the earth to actually make some real progress, because we've basically been playing defense and heading off bad ideas, and in the meantime, you know, the fate of the planet is in danger, and it's time to actually turn this around and start making progress, because we don't have much time to do things like stop global warming.
now all of a sudden there's kind of a new perspective on the environment, a new way of looking at the future, and it's extremely challenging because now we're supposed to really get out there and get something done. Let's start out with the effect from the change in the House specifically. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are saying, wow, Richard Pombo is gone. Talk about the effect that Richard Pombo had in charting a vision of America's future and what it means now that he's gone, because he was so active, as well as others, but he in particular seemed to be the person who really was, the in many respects, the forefront of this right-wing agenda.
Well, Richard Pombo was the chair of the House Resources Committee, and as a result, he basically controlled the agenda on most environmental matters outside the energy arena in the House of Representatives, which doesn't mean that the Pombo agenda was being adopted. I mean, the guy was so extreme and radical and out of the mainstream of American opinion that he was fairly ineffective, even though he was a chairman. Yes, he managed to get his modification of the Endangered Species Act through the House of Representatives, but it stalled there. But his other initiatives, whether it was to sell off the national parks or open up the coast to renewed oil and gas leasing or any of the other things he was promoting, by and large, didn't even pass the House, let alone get adopted into national law. It is great to have him gone because now we have a situation where we can actually focus on the real issues and the real solutions rather than wasting time and having to just fight bad ideas coming from Richard Pombo over and over again, year after year after year. We have been losing time. We've been losing traction on the real issues of the day, like combating global warming and recovering endangered species and, you know, protecting our public lands and coming up with real solutions to our energy problem, which was the main environmental issue that was on voters' minds. I mean, basically, Richard Pombo wanted us to have more oil and gas and more coal and more destruction of our public lands and wedding us further to our fossil fuel addiction. And yet, his opponent, Jerry McNerney, was basically saying, no, there is a brighter, cleaner, smarter, cheaper, and more secure energy solution, and that's the way we need to be going, and that's what the voters in California 11 were saying. But frankly, that's what the voters all across the board were saying. If you look at the governor's races, if you look at the state legislative races, if you look at the congressional races, the main environmental issue that was out there was talking about energy security. But it wasn't talking about sending more troops into Iraq for energy security. It was talking about real energy security, which is coming up with sensible, new, clean, renewable resources at home.
It gives us the chance to have some moderated talk. I think when we're perpetually having to argue with these extreme ideas, it just changes the movement of the discussion. And I'm hoping that now a more reasonable and reasoned debate will be happening. And I think that's going to make it easier. What do you think is going to happen as a result of this shift? Where do you see some positives? Where do you see some challenges?
Well, I think moderation is really the watchword these days. I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi, for all the vilification that the radical right and Karl Rove tried to do, you know, is not coming forward with a super leftist progressive agenda. She realizes that the people that were elected that put her in power as the presumptive Speaker of the House tend to be moderates. They tend to represent the mainstream. They tend to represent rural districts, and they got a bunch of rural votes, and they got those rural votes because people were looking for a course change, but they weren't looking for, you know, trying to adopt some radical leftist agenda. And so, you know, she's having to unify her party and come forward with common sense bipartisan solutions. George Bush, now having to eat so much crow, is saying he wants to be bipartisan. He wants to be a uniter and not a divider, which is interesting after 6 years of being the biggest divider in the country. But nevertheless, you know, it's welcome news. I mean, if he'll actually roll up his shirt sleeves and try to reach across the aisle and work with people, we could actually make some progress this next 2 years. On the other hand, if he wants to continue to appease the radical right and the extremists within his own party, then we're basically going to have 2 years of stalemate. But I think what you will see coming from Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi in the Congress are basically, you know, common sense solutions. you know, let's increase the efficiency standards for appliances. Let's try to remove the huge tax breaks we've got for the oil and gas industry, where they're basically reaping windfall profits at taxpayer expense, and let's instead start trying to figure out how to boost production of renewable resources here, whether it's agricultural fuels or, you know, solar energy or wind energy. Those kind of things are being ignored and underfunded at the same time we've been lavishing the subsidies on nuclear power and fossil fuels. And so those are the kind of changes I think are going to happen, and they're going to be welcome changes, and there's going to be Republicans that are supporting them as well as Democrats, and we're suddenly going to find that we can have consensus and we can move the country forward.
There's a group of new legislators now that will be, they're actually in D.C. now as we speak, and they're going through their training and getting ready to seize the reins of power and move forward. Any of the new legislators who you are particularly interested in or who capture your attention?
Well, all across the board. I would start, you know, here in California with Jerry McNerney, who defeated Richard Pombo in California 11. It was really the only turnover we had in a congressional seat here in California, but it was a monumental turnover because you have in Pombo somebody who I said was wedded to fossil fuels and opening up the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and opening up the California coast to drilling, and he's being replaced by somebody who says, you know, I'm a wind power entrepreneur and I want to try to figure out how to wean this country from fossil fuels and move in the direction of renewable energy, create, you know, a real industry for that in my district and in California so that we can be leaders of the country. You know, so that's one example. But if you look across the board in the new people that were elected, they generally all had the same agenda, which was, you know, let's stop trying to defend American interests in Iraq and think that the only solution to solving our energy problems is to send troops to the Middle East, and instead let's try to figure out how to get some homegrown energy solutions that provide for the long haul.
You champion the move that unites the national with the state and local. Talk about how you see the results of the election playing on the ground in the state level.
Well, I still think that is the most favorable forum for making progress right now, because unfortunately, even though there has been a slight shift in Congress, I mean, yes, the Democrats took over control, but control in the Senate means 51-49 vote. And you basically need at least 60 votes in the Senate in order to rule, in order to really get your way because of the filibuster rules that they have there. So, you know, we're a long way from being able to move forward a progressive agenda, especially when we have George Bush still sitting in the White House and unwilling to sign bills that will actually move this country forward in the direction that it needs to go. Which is a very dramatic shift from the way that he's been leading us the last 6 years. So with that in mind, we continue to need to invest at the state level because we can't just wait for a greener Congress and a greener president to come forward. But there's tremendous progress that can be made and has to be made at the state level. California is leading the way. This last session, we passed AB 32, which is the most progressive piece of global warming legislation in the country. You know, we passed the Million Solar Roofs Initiative. There's lots of good stuff happening in this state, and we're busy trying to export those ideas to other states. So when California passes clean car legislation, the so-called Pavley Law, we didn't just stop there and say, well, California has it, but we then took it and had it adopted in Oregon, in Washington, in New Mexico, in Arizona, the entire New England states, you know, all across the country. And now we have a third of the North American auto market saying, we want to have the same kind of clean car standards that California is promoting, which will not only give us cleaner cars, but will also combat global warming. Now, once you have that, you know, Detroit is then going to be forced to make cleaner fleets for the entire country. So you don't have to wait for Congress in order to make progress if you can get enough progress made state by state by state. When George Bush refused to clamp down on mercury pollution coming from coal-fired power plants, we basically went to the states, and one by one by one, and we've now got 15 different states, have adopted tougher standards than George Bush's, saying we aren't going to stand to have our citizens poisoned by mercury. We're going to adopt a tougher standard. The interesting thing is that these people that claim they're all in favor of states' rights that are all over the Bush administration hated when the states adopt anything that's tougher than the weak federal standard that they've put in place in order to appease industry. And so this will be the big challenge, because right now, as we've got states leading the way, we've got the Bush administration and industry challenging the states in the courts, saying you can't be allowed in order to pass a tougher standard than the federal standard.
That is the conflict about national control and local control, and it comes in many colors and shapes. Let's also move this out into the big picture, because quite honestly, nothing has changed except our hope and our potential, hopefully, to make change and to have real discussions and deal with problems. But the problems, as we move day to day, month to month, year to year, just seem to be mounting. For example, global warming is achieving critical mass in terms of its acceptance around the world. People are out as well talking about mass extinction and the destruction of coral reefs throughout the oceans, and as well now a recent study that says that, for example, fish species may be essentially gone from the oceans by, and this is a shocking reality, I'm going to be talking with someone from Scripps who was part of this study, by 2048.
Mm-hmm.
Those are extraordinary challenges, and so although the politics have changed, the challenges haven't changed. All that's happened is that we can now perhaps talk about them. How are we going to start to utilize both our national and our local, this change in the power structure and the vision to address such absolutely devastating prospects for the future?
Well, first we have to get out of a state of denial, which is where the Bush administration and the radical right congressional leadership has been for the last 6 years. When we had a chair of the Senate Environment Committee, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who thought that global warming was a hoax and that it wasn't real and that there was no reason to do anything, and we needed to just continue to study it in perpetuity. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking. The top scientists in this country and in the world say we have 10 years to turn this around, and if we don't, the carbon that we will introduce into the atmosphere over the next 10 years will be up there for the next 100 years, and it will basically make it impossible to reverse the catastrophic effects of global warming. Heavy sea level rises, massive drought, massive flooding, dramatic climate collapse. And so we have 10 years to turn that around, and that's not 10 years when we can be sitting debating and studying, which is what the Bush administration and Senator Inhofe wanted to do. Well, now we have a situation where California Senator Barbara Boxer is very likely to be the next chair of the Senate Environment Committee. And she believes that the time to act is now. She wants to take the California AB 32 legislation on global warming and introduce it and ultimately pass it in the Senate so that we have that as our new federal policy. Now, that isn't going to be passed in the next 2 years and signed by George Bush, but if she can get it introduced, start lining up sponsors, have those hearings, educate the Congress and educate the American people and use the bully pulpit of that chairmanship in order to do that, then post-2008, we potentially can pass that kind of legislation. And at the same time, if we're taking AB 32 and trying to pass it in numerous state legislatures across the country, that will build momentum and put pressure on those state congressional delegations to end up supporting a Boxer bill at the federal level. So those are the kind of things that we need to do. We've got to dramatically change. I mean, here we have, you know, the next big climate summit happening right now in Nairobi, Kenya. The rest of the world is basically saying we've got to address global warming now, and if we don't, we are going to have massive drought, massive starvation, massive migration. Entire countries will disappear with rising sea level. And yet, the Bush administration is still saying we don't want to have any mandatory controls because we're worried about our economy and what it will do. Well, frankly, the rest of the world believes that the future of the economy is in investing in clean energy solutions and addressing this issue, and the country that gets to the front of the line and starts developing the technology and marketing the technology to the rest of the world about how to solve global warming is going to be the leader of the future. And we are basically ignoring that chance to assert leadership and instead are becoming the biggest naysayers on the planet. We produce the most pollution, we're the biggest contributor to global warming, and we're also the biggest outlaw because we're the only major industrialized nation in the world that doesn't recognize this as a problem and has refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol.
So the hope, of course, is that this change is going to, as I say, change the dialogue such that it can start to change the attitude and the awareness of the public at large, because that is what really matters. People must be aware. People on the street, people in the fields, in the back country, all have to become conscious of the fact that we must act now. So in that regard, I'd like to give you this chance to literally address your membership in the Sierra Club and tell them what they need to be thinking about in the year, let's say the next year and two. I'd certainly welcome anyone else hearing that message to participate and join in your effort.
Well, first let me say that the issue of global warming is not strictly an environmental issue. And if it is only environmentalists talking to environmentalists and mobilizing environmentalists, we will fail. This needs to be recognized, as Al Gore says, as the moral challenge of our time. And whether you are a hunter, an angler, a farmer, a steel worker, you know, whatever your line of work, you have a stake in global warming. We are going to have a situation in this country where everybody needs to recognize that the future of the planet, the future of our economy, the future of everybody's line of work is at stake if global warming isn't corrected within the next decade. And so as a result, my message to Sierra Club people is stop talking to Sierra Club people and start talking to the people in your congregation on Sunday. Go talk to your neighbor, whether they're a Sierra Club member or not. You know, go talk to, you know, the local union hall. You know, go talk to, you know, everybody that you can reach out to in as many possible ways as you can. Because if everybody doesn't start addressing this, and everybody take it responsibly, and everybody take it seriously, and everybody realize that there will be some changes that are necessary, but these are going to be changes for the good, then we're all going to fail. This needs to be a collective exercise. And yes, we still want to work to protect national parks and wilderness areas and endangered species and all those things, but all those will be lost if we don't address climate change. You can draw a circle around redwoods or sequoias and say we've got a new national park or we've got a new national monument or a new state park, but those trees will die if climate change occurs as it's being projected to happen. Similarly, you can establish critical habitat for, you know, some endangered species, but that species will die if climate change happens. They just can't migrate that fast in order to adapt. So, you know, regardless of what you care about, you know, as a conservationist or as an environmentalist, whether you like to hunt, fish, bird watch, or whatever, it's all at risk with global warming. And as a result, I urge everybody to get involved in this campaign and encourage everybody else in society to get involved in this and demand change in this country. We have to get our local governments, we have to get our college campuses, we've got to get our state government, we've got to get the federal government, all responsibly addressing this and recognizing that it's not somebody else's problem, but it's our problem. Every choice we make every day, you know, can help deal with this, but it's not just a matter of personal choice. You know, yes, you can get a more fuel-efficient car, yes, you can insulate your house, but at the same time, if we don't also hold corporations and local governments, everybody else in society accountable for their decisions and their choices and give them better choices and better solutions, then we're all going to fail collectively.
Bruce Hamilton with the Sierra Club. If people want to turn to the Sierra Club to learn a lot more about these issues, what's the best way for them to find you?
Well, if you go up on the World Wide Web and just type in SierraClub.org, you will find our website, and that will put you in touch with your local chapter, or it'll put you in touch with our national offices. And we'd be delighted to hear from you. We'd be delighted to have you join us, and we'd be delighted to partner with you if you're another organization and want to work with us on these common problems.
Bruce Hamilton, National Conservation Director with the Sierra Club, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
If only we had a map that we could all agree on and then decide where we are and where we want to go. We've done that 1,000 times in our hikes, adventures, and misadventures. Mapping Our World is coming up when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can't Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I know that at some point, and for many of you quite recently, you've grabbed a folded piece of paper, folded with a purpose, and began opening it up until it lay sprawled before you. And then you looked, and your finger came up and began moving along the paper, and suddenly you said, "That's it. That's where we are. Maps." And once you know where you are, you get to choose where you want to go and how you want to get there. If only we had a map to our future. Hold on. We'll be right back. I'm talking to Will Teft, who is with MapLink. Are you the founder, or what's your role in it?
But I've been at MapLink almost 15 years.
Yeah. Now, what is MapLink?
Well, MapLink is a consolidator. We bring every published map on Earth together into one warehouse, and then resell them to libraries and institutions, but most importantly, bookstores, map stores, and other retail companies. We handle about 100,000 different titles from all over the world. Hundreds of different map publishers from all over the world, every continent. We buy things. Things are shipped in by air, by bus, by truck. They're hand carried, and many times in the developing world, we have to bring maps in by hand. That is, we literally have to go to some of these countries and bring them back ourselves in our luggage. The name MapLink really means we bring the map publishers and the people who want to use the maps together. And the wonderful thing about MapLink is that we've become kind of the hub of a very diverse and very locally used type of business or industry. You know, most maps of, say, Boston are used in Boston, and they're going to be published in Boston. And the very best maps of Florence, Italy, or the very best maps of Madagascar are going to usually be published in those particular places. What we have done is we've taken the work and gone and found these things, bring them back, and so we can offer titles like everything from Yosemite High Country to the ice fields of Alberta. What we do is we go and get the maps and we bring them back and offer them out of a catalog, our website. MapLink.com is our website where people can go and find out generally if a given title is available for a particular place. We publish 40 or 50 titles, but only because nobody else did or does. And usually a particular title, for example, Tibet, we publish a beautiful map of Tibet because nobody else did. And so we worked with a map maker, a cartographer in Budapest, Hungary, and she and I developed this map of Tibet. And it is the definitive reference map for that part of the world.
Well, as far as I know, there is no one that can compete with your collection.
The only competition we face, frankly, Sydney, is with a publisher. Individual publishers still sell direct to their consumers, either the public or retailers. So we don't have any exclusive arrangements with these publishers. We are a unique business in the world, pretty much.
I guess what I'm trying to say is if a person were trying to find a map, you'd be a good place to start.
Oh, indeed. We're on the speed dial of every major media company, every Library of Congress, Map Room, the National Geographic Society, all have us on their telephone directory. When somebody calls up and they want a map of some place that they don't have, call MapLink.
Let's talk about the website. Where is that?
The website, www.maplink, M-A-P-L-I-N-K, like a chain, .com. And it's where you can go and you can look up titles, see the date, the scale. You can even see a little thumbnail picture of each title. We have about 150,000 different titles on there, and many of those titles can be obscure topo maps from Peru or from South Africa or, you know, places around the world. We also stock all the USGS topographical maps for all 50 states.
So a person can come in and do a search through your site. They get a map, and it's priced at, what, $6.95, $10.95, $2.95? What kind of price points do you offer them?
I think nowadays the spread's usually beginning about $3 and then going on up from there. But I think most maps are in the $8 to $12 range. Most of the titles that we carry are either going to be folded, they're going to be rolled for wall maps, or they're going to be bound up in a book like a road atlas or a street atlas. Road atlases and street atlases tend to be more of a professional type product, and you're going to see those in the $15 to $40 range. Folding maps, like I said, are in the $8 to $12 range. And then rolled maps are probably also in the $10 to $20 area, depending if they're laminated or paper. Just to give you an example, we have probably 25 different world wall maps.
As I'm looking at this little twirl about the stand here, there's amazing places here, some of which I can't even pronounce. Burkina Faso, where's that?
Burkina Faso, a country in Africa. It's in West Africa. And this publisher that does these is he's located in Vancouver, Canada, and he does a whole series of maps for virtually every country on Earth. Here's another one he does of Swaziland. We've got things of bike routes in Oakland, California. We've got maps of the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, Aspen, Colorado, Lake Havasu. Here's a hiking and biking map for Burlington, Vermont, everything. And then getting a little bit more high-tech, we also offer a fair amount number of CD-ROM products when they're available. Here I'm holding some really great map coverage for Australia. This one's of the Kimberleys, this other one's of Cape York. Now, most of the CD-ROM material comes to us from our traditional map publisher vendors. So if a map publisher vendor is bringing out some CD-ROM product, then we'll more than likely add that as part of the list.
To what degree do you think that's the future is in the CD interactive maps? Because they are very powerful.
You know, the CD interactive maps are very powerful, but we haven't seen a slacking off or a decrease in the number of paper fold tip, just standard traditional paper maps and atlases sold. In fact, we've seen an increase. And we think that the more people are aware of maps, the more people are going to be buying them and using them, and that they're going to discovering the benefits that they offer and the tremendous variety that's available out there. You know, we don't have just one map of a given place. We may have as many, like places like Paris and London, we may have as many as 50 different titles.
With 50 maps from Paris, how would a person go about deciding what would be the best map?
Well, they call us, talk to our customer service people, and help pick them out. A lot of our retailer customers, a lot of bookstores and map stores and outdoor stores that we're dealing with, they want something that is very popular, that's a best-selling title, something with a good name recognition. In Europe, there are quite a number of publishers that have name recognition. In the United States, there are publishers with name recognition. So usually the ones that are that sell the best are the best recognized. However, there are cases where sometimes the very best map isn't always the one that you might think of. I can show you a great example here. There's a fellow in Oregon named David Imus who does this a map of Oregon, and he's just come out with this new map of Alaska. I think it's one of the finest maps of Alaska available.
Now, what do you like about that?
Well, this particular map is very, very reasonably priced at $9.95. But the detail that it has to offer and the reputation of the cartographer, the reputation of the map maker, is very, very high. This fellow produces very, very good quality material, uses the best data, and then he produces a product that's a very, very good informational value.
As I look at this, obviously the radio audience can't see this, but it's extremely rich with variations in color, a fine print. So there's a lot of information on this. For example, go up into the North Slope area, where, of course, there's so much issue about wildlife and the issues of oil and mining, and it really does give you a sense of the richness of the water. All these little tiny water inlets along that coastal area, which other maps don't seem to do. I agree. That's interesting.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The fact that he shows so much of the water and the little lakes in the area, and it isn't possible at the scale of this particular map. It isn't possible to show all the lakes. If you've ever seen pictures, if you've ever been up there, there are millions of lakes. I'm so glad you pointed this out, because he does give you enough of a clue or a representation of it to really give you that sense.
Well, it's obvious on so many maps that kind of indicate that that's an area with little tiny lakes, but this actually has them on there.
Yes.
You know, so just as I look at the map top, you know, from the perspective of the visual impact, that tells a story that otherwise you wouldn't see.
It sure does, and the other thing that he adds is relief shading and relief coloring, so the higher points get a different color than the points closer to sea level, so you get a sense of the terrain, how rugged it is, and the difference between the low areas and the high areas. Another thing I like about this map is that it has Alaska all in one, all connected in one contiguous sheet. So you've got the whole Aleutian chain all out on and the peninsula area all on one continuous sheet.
There are some maps that are indestructible. I'm always amazed at the paper, and then there are some that fall apart the second time you open them up. What should people look for in terms of just that durability?
That's a great question. You know, there's some publishers who cater to a particular market niche. Hiking and climbing, but in particular, need a really good, rugged, waterproof map. And some publishers have published their entire line using waterproof paper. Here's one publisher, Tom Harrison. National Geographic, through their Trails Illustrated brand of maps, is another line that do a completely waterproof map. So it's indestructible. Now, let's be honest, a lot of map publishers are going to rely on the fact that perhaps that map that is going to self-destruct, and you might want to need to get a new one a little bit later on. So we don't want them to last absolutely forever, but I do have some an example of a map. This is a bandana map, and what it is, it's a bandana with a very detailed, perfectly readable topographic map printed on it. And wouldn't you say that's a readable topo map?
Absolutely. I see all of the topographic features, including in the water. Oh, that's a Mount Rainier. Okay. So that's actually an aerial view there. You're going up into the snow zone there. Yeah, very, very cool. Now, this is you wear this, and therefore you keep the map with you all the time?
Exactly. And I've seen these maps go through the wash about 8 or 10 times and still have a perfectly readable, perfectly acceptable map. This same company produces the maps like this for many, many national parks around the country.
What's the most popular map that MapLink has available?
Well, I think the most popular maps now are either going to be based sort of a general political world map, kind of map that you would give to a school kid. Rand McNally, Hammond, Michelin, are all National Geographic are all publishers of maps like that. Those are probably the biggest selling maps. But the biggest selling single specialty map title is probably a plastic laminated map of Manhattan called Streetwise Manhattan. That map probably just sells more than any other single title in the world. It just got a huge market, and it is a very, very, very successful title.
Since you're in the biz, do you get into some of the antiquarian maps? Is that a fascination of yours?
Yes, I'm very much interested in it. Still maintain connections with people through the California Map Society and other groups that are involved in collecting rare maps and talking about it. And there's so much good material on the internet on dealing with old and rare maps. So one website that I would really recommend to all your listeners to go see is David Rumsey. .com. That's one word, DavidRumsey.com. That is, to me, truly the most exceptional website dealing with old and rare maps. This fellow is a rare map collector who's taken, he's scanned his entire map collection and put them all up on the web for people to look at and to manipulate and use, and use some of these high-tech GIS tools to engage the viewer. And what he's allowed people to do in some areas, for example Boston and San Francisco, is you can actually overlay all of his collection of different maps of, say, San Francisco from different eras, and he's got them all done up at the same scale, so you can compare them, and an incredible amount of historical research, and just, it's a wonderful site. I recommend it.
I'm definitely going to check out your website. I don't know that I've been there, but I'm definitely going to check that out, and I certainly encourage people to do so, because it's a fascinating realm. And what is it, after a lifetime or however long you've met this, looking at maps, that you think you've gained that you'd like to share with the world?
Oh, my. Well, the best thing that I found is just how wonderful everybody in the business has been, and how it's brought me in contact with people like yourself, but also people just all over the world who are involved in the business. In being in this business, I've been able to travel and do business in other parts of the world and bring their products back here to share with other people. And to me, I mean, that to me is really the best part of it all, is just bringing the whole world together with all of these different things. In many of these maps are, these are labors of love. Many of these titles come out from, you know, maybe one person working in their studio and so on. Being able to bring some of that stuff to light, traveling around, talking about maps, teaching kids about the variety and the distinctiveness of maps, that maps are interesting and they're worth studying, and they're also, I have to say, that they're worth paying for. Maps are worth paying for. There's so much variety, so many different things out there, that we don't have to accept just one type of map, one kind of map, one map from one publisher. There are so many other others that are available, and that they are worth buying and worth paying for.
We've been talking with Will Teft of MapLink. Give us your website again.
My website, thanks, Sydney. My website is www.maplink.com.
I encourage everybody to go there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Sydney. Great to be here.
So, there's just so many choices and so much to see and so many places to go and adventures and challenges and mysteries, and it all comes down to the choices we make or don't make and the maps we choose to rely on. We update the route every single week here on the Wild Side News to help us keep moving to a better tomorrow. So choose to tune in each Thursday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth walks the talk. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.
Well, I-